We of the cafeterie were the very dregs of the hotel, despised and tutoyed by everyone. There were various others, the office employees, called generally courier, the storekeeper, the cellarman, some porters and pages, the iceman, the bakers, the night watchman, the doorkeeper. Different jobs were done by different races. The office employees and the cooks and sewing women were French. The waiters, Italians and Germans. There is hardly such a thing as a French waiter in Paris. The plongeurs of every race in Europe, besides Arabs and Negroes. French was the lingua franca, even the Italians speaking it to one another. All the departments had their special perquisites. In all Paris hotels it is the custom to sell the broken bread to bakers for 8 sous a pound, and the kitchen scraps to pig keepers for a trifle, and to divide the proceeds of this among the plongeurs. There was much pilfering, too. The waiters all stole food. In fact, I seldom saw a waiter trouble to eat the rations provided for him by the hotel. And the cooks did it on a larger scale in the kitchen, and we in the cafeterie swilled illicit tea and coffee. The cellarman stole brandy. By a rule of the hotel, the waiters were not allowed to keep stores of spirits, but had to go to the cellarman for each drink as it was ordered. As the cellarman poured out the drinks, he would set aside perhaps a teaspoonful from each glass, and he amassed quantities in this way. He would sell you the stolen brandy for 5 sous a swig, if he thought he could trust you. There were thieves among the staff, and if you left money in your coat pockets, it was generally taken. The doorkeeper, who paid our wages and searched us for stolen food, was the greatest thief in the hotel. Out of my 500 francs a month, this man actually managed to cheat me of 114 francs in 6 weeks. I had asked to be paid daily, so the doorkeeper paid me 16 francs each evening, and by not paying for Sundays, for which, of course, payment was due, pocketed 64 francs. Also, I sometimes worked on a Sunday, for which, though I didn't know it, I was entitled to an extra 25 francs. The doorkeeper never paid me this either, and so made away with another 75 francs. I only realized during my last week that I was being cheated, and as I could prove nothing, only 25 francs were refunded. The doorkeeper played similar tricks on any employee who was fool enough to be taken in. He called himself a Greek, but in reality he was an Armenian. After knowing him, I saw the force of the proverb, "Trust a snake before a Jew, and a Jew before a Greek, but don't trust an Armenian." There were queer characters among the waiters. One was a gentleman, a youth who had been educated at a university and had had a well-paid job in a business office. He had caught a venereal disease, lost his job, drifted, and now considered himself lucky to be a waiter. Many of the waiters had slipped into France without passports, and one or two of them were spies. It's a common profession for a spy to adopt. One day there was a fearful row in the waiters' dining room between Mirandi, a dangerous-looking man with eyes set too far apart, and another Italian. It appeared that Morandi had taken the other man's mistress. The other man, a weakling and obviously frightened of Morandi, was threatening vaguely. Morandi jeered at him, "Well, what are you going to do about it? I've slept with your girl, slept with her 3 times. It was fine. What can you do, huh? I can denounce you to the secret police. You're an Italian spy." Morandi did not deny it. He simply produced a razor from his tail pocket and made 2 swift strokes in the air, as though slashing a man's cheeks open, whereat the other waiter took it back. The queerest type I ever saw in the hotel was an extra. He had been engaged at 25 francs for the day to replace the Magyar, who was ill. He was a Serbian, a thick-set, nimble fellow of about 25, speaking 6 languages, including English. He seemed to know all about hotel work, and up till midday he worked like a slave. Then, as soon as it had struck 12, he turned sulky, shirked his work, stole wine, and finally crowned all by loafing about openly with a pipe in his mouth. Smoking, of course, was forbidden under severe penalties. The manager himself heard of it, and came down to interview the Serbian, fuming with rage. "What the devil do you mean by smoking here?" he cried. "What the devil do you mean by having a face like that?" answered the Serbian, calmly. I cannot convey the blasphemy of such a remark. The head cook, if the plongeur had spoken to him like that, would have thrown a saucepan of hot soup in his face. The manager said instantly, "You're sacked." And at 2 o'clock, the Serbian was given his 25 francs and duly sacked. Before he went out, Boris asked him in Russian what game he was playing. He said, the Serbian answered, "Look here, mon vieux, they've got to pay me a day's wages if I work up to midday, haven't they? That's the law. And where's the sense of working after I get my wages? So I tell you what I do. I go to an hotel, and I get a job as an extra, and up to midday I work hard. Then, the moment it's struck 12, I start raising such hell that they've no choice but to sack me. Neat, eh? Most days I'm sacked by 12:30. Today it was 2 o'clock, but I don't care. I've saved 4 hours' work. The only trouble is one can't do it at the same hotel twice." It appeared that he had played this game at half the hotels and restaurants in Paris. It is probably quite an easy game to play during the summer, though the hotels protect themselves against it as well as they can by means of a blacklist.
This ends Disc 2. Down and Out in Paris and London, Disc 3.
Chapter 14. In a few days, I had grasped the main principles on which the hotel was run. The thing that would astonish anyone coming for the first time into the service quarters of an hotel would be the fearful noise and disorder during the rush hours. It is something so different from the steady work in a shop or a factory that it looks at first sight like mere bad management. But it is really quite unavoidable, and for this reason. Hotel work is not particularly hard, but by its nature it comes in rushes and cannot be economised. You cannot, for instance, grill a steak 2 hours before it's wanted. You have to wait till the last moment, by which time a mass of other work has accumulated, and then do it all together in frantic haste. The result is that at meal times everyone is doing two men's work, which is impossible without noise and quarrelling. Indeed, the quarrels are a necessary part of the process, for the pace would never be kept up if everyone didn't accuse everyone else of idling. It was for this reason that during the rush hours the whole staff raged and cursed like demons. At those times there was scarcely a verb in the hotel except foutre. A girl in the bakery, aged 16, used oaths that would have defeated a cabman. Did not Hamlet say cursing like a scullion? No doubt Shakespeare had watched scullions at work. But we're not losing our heads and wasting time. We were just stimulating one another for the effort of packing 4 hours' work into 2 hours. What keeps an hotel going is the fact that the employees take a genuine pride in their work, beastly and silly though it is. If a man idles, the others soon find him out and conspire against him to get him sacked. Cooks, waiters and plongeurs differ greatly in outlook, but they are all alike in being proud of their efficiency. Undoubtedly the most workmanlike class, and the least servile, are the cooks. They don't earn quite as much as waiters, but their prestige is higher and their employment steadier. The cook does not look upon himself as a servant, but as a skilled workman. He is generally called an ouvrier, which a waiter never is. He knows his power, knows that he alone makes or mars a restaurant, and that if he is 5 minutes late, everything is out of gear. He despises the whole non-cooking staff and makes it a point of honour to insult everyone below the head waiter. And he takes a genuine artistic pride in his work, which demands very great skill. It is not the cooking that is so difficult, but the doing everything to time. Between breakfast and luncheon, the head cook at the Hotel X would receive orders for several hundred dishes, all to be served at different times. He cooked few of them himself, but he gave instructions about all of them and inspected before they were sent up. His memory was wonderful. The vouchers were pinned on a board, but the head cook seldom looked at them. Everything was stored in his mind, and exactly to the minute as each dish fell due, he would call out, "Faites marcher une côtelette de veau," or whatever it was, unfailingly. He was an insufferable bully, but he was also an artist. It is for their punctuality, and not for any superiority in technique, that men cooks are preferred to women. The waiter's outlook is quite different. He too is proud in a way of his skill, but his skill is chiefly in being servile. His work gives him the mentality not of a workman, but of a snob. He lives perpetually in the sight of rich people, stands at their tables, listens to their conversation, sucks up to them with smiles and discreet little jokes. He has the pleasure of spending money by proxy. Moreover, there is always the chance that he may become rich himself, for, though most waiters die poor, they have long runs of luck occasionally. At some cafés on the Grand Boulevard, there is so much money to be made that the waiters actually pay the patron for their employment. The result is that, between constantly seeing money and hoping to get it, the waiter comes to identify himself to some extent with his employers. He will take pains to serve a meal in style, because he feels that he is participating in the meal himself. I remember Valenti telling me of some banquet at Nice at which he had once served, and of how it cost 200,000 francs and was talked of for months afterwards. "It was splendid, mon petit. Mais magnifique! Jesus Christ! The champagne, the silver, the orchids. I have never seen anything like them, and I have seen some things. Ah, it was glorious!" "But," I said, "you were only there to wait." "Oh, of course. But still, it was splendid." The moral is, never be sorry for a waiter. Sometimes when you sit in a restaurant, still stuffing yourself half an hour after closing time, you feel that the tired waiter at your side must surely be despising you. But he is not. He is not thinking, as he looks at you, "What an overfed lout." He is thinking, "One day when I have saved enough money, I shall be able to imitate that man." He is ministering to a kind of pleasure he thoroughly understands and admires. And that is why waiters are seldom socialists, have no effective trade union, and will work 12 hours a day. They work 15 hours, 7 days a week in many cafes. They are snobs, and they find the servile nature of their work rather congenial. The plongeurs, again, have a different outlook. Theirs is a job which offers no prospects, is intensely exhausting, and at the same time has not a trace of skill or interest, the sort of job that would always be done by women if women were strong enough. All that is required of them is to be constantly on the run and to put up with long hours in a stuffy atmosphere. They have no way of escaping from this life, for they cannot save a penny from their wages, and working from 60 to 100 hours a week leaves them no time to train for anything else. The best they can hope for is to find a slightly softer job as night watchman or lavatory attendant. And yet the plongeurs, low as they are, also have a kind of pride. It's the pride of the drudge, the man who is equal to no matter what quantity of work. At that level, the mere power to go on working like an ox is about the only virtue attainable. Débrouillard is what every plongeur wants to be called. A débrouillard is a man who, even when he is told to do the impossible, will se débrouiller, get it done somehow. One of the kitchen plongeurs at the Hotel Aix, a German, was well known as a débrouillard. One night an English lord came to the hotel, and the waiters were in despair, for the lord had asked for peaches, and there were none in stock. It was late at night. Shops would be shut. "Leave it to me," said the German. He went out, and in 10 minutes he was back with 4 peaches. He had gone into a neighbouring restaurant and stolen them. That is what is meant by a débrouillard. The English lord paid for the peaches at 20 francs each. Mario, who was in charge of the cafeterie, had the typical drudge mentality. All he thought of was getting through the boulot, and he defied you to give him too much of it. 14 years underground had left him with about as much natural laziness as a piston rod. "Faut être dur," he used to say when anyone complained. You will often hear plongeurs boast, "Je suis dur," as though they were soldiers, not male charwomen. Thus, everyone in the hotel had his sense of honour. And when the press of work came, we were all ready for a grand, concerted effort to get through it. The constant war between the different departments also made for efficiency, for everyone clung to his own privileges and tried to stop the others idling and pilfering. This is the good side of hotel work. In an hotel, a huge and complicated machine is kept running by an inadequate staff, because every man has a well-defined job and does it scrupulously. But there is a weak point, and it is this, that the job the staff are doing is not necessarily what the customer pays for. The customer pays, as he sees it, for good service. The employee is paid, as he sees it, for the boulot, meaning, as a rule, an imitation of good service. The result is that though hotels are miracles of punctuality, they are worse than the worst private houses in the things that matter. Take cleanliness, for example. The dirt in the Hotel X, as soon as one penetrated into the service quarters, was revolting. Our cafeterie had year-old filth in all the dark corners, and the bread bin was infested with cockroaches. Once I suggested killing these beasts to Mario. "Why, kill the poor animals," he said reproachfully. The others laughed when I wanted to wash my hands before touching the butter. Yet we were clean where we recognised cleanliness as part of the boulot. We scrubbed the tables and polished the brasswork regularly, because we had orders to do that. But we had no orders to be genuinely clean, and in any case we had no time for it. We were simply carrying out our duties, and as our first duty was punctuality, we saved time by being dirty. In the kitchen the dirt was worse. It is not a figure of speech, it is a mere statement of fact, to say that a French cook will spit in the soup. That is, if he is not going to drink it himself. He is an artist, but his art is not cleanliness. To a certain extent, he is even dirty because he is an artist. For food, to look smart, needs dirty treatment. When a steak, for instance, is brought up for the head cook's inspection, he does not handle it with a fork. He picks it up in his fingers and slaps it down, runs his thumb round the dish and licks it to taste the gravy, runs it round and licks again, then steps back and contemplates the piece of meat, like an artist judging a picture, then presses it lovingly into place with his fat pink fingers, every one of which he has licked 100 times that morning. When he is satisfied, he takes a cloth and wipes his fingerprints from the dish and hands it to the waiter. And the waiter, of course, dips his fingers into the gravy, his nasty, greasy fingers, which he is forever running through his brilliantine hair. Whenever one pays more than, say, 10 francs for a dish of meat in Paris, one may be certain that it has been fingered in this manner. In very cheap restaurants it's different. There the same trouble is not taken over the food, and it is just forked out of the pan and flung onto a plate, without handling. Roughly speaking, the more one pays for food, the more sweat and spittle one is obliged to eat with it. Dirtiness is inherent in hotels and restaurants, because sound food is sacrificed to punctuality and smartness. The hotel employee is too busy getting food ready to remember that it is meant to be eaten. A meal is simply une commande to him, just as a man dying of cancer is simply a case to the doctor. A customer orders, for example, a piece of toast. Somebody, pressed with work in a cellar deep underground, has to prepare it. How can he stop and say to himself, "This toast is to be eaten, I must make it eatable"? All he knows is that it must look right and must be ready in 3 minutes. Some large drops of sweat fall from his forehead onto the toast. Why should he worry? Presently the toast falls among the filthy sawdust on the floor. Why trouble to make a new piece? It's much quicker to wipe the sawdust off. On the way upstairs the toast falls again, butter side down. Another wipe is all it needs. And so with everything. The only food at the Hotel X which was ever prepared cleanly was the staff's and the patron's. The maxim, repeated by everyone, was, "Look out for the patron, and as for the clients, s'en fiche pas mal." Everywhere in the service quarters dirt festered, a secret vein of dirt running through the great garish hotel like the intestines through a man's body. Apart from the dirt, the patrons swindled the customers wholeheartedly. For the most part, the materials of the food were very bad, though the cooks knew how to serve it up in style. The meat was at best ordinary, and as to the vegetables, no good housekeeper would have looked at them in the market. The cream, by a standing order, was diluted with milk, the tea and coffee were of inferior sorts, and the jam was synthetic stuff out of vast unlabeled tins. All the cheaper wines, according to Boris, were corked vin ordinaire. There was a rule that employees must pay for anything they spoiled, and in consequence damaged things were seldom thrown away. Once the waiter on the third floor dropped a roast chicken down the shaft of our service lift, where it fell into a litter of broken bread, torn paper, and so forth at the bottom. We simply wiped it with a cloth and sent it up again. Upstairs there were dirty tales of once-used sheets not being washed, but simply damped, ironed, and put back on the beds. The patron was as mean to us as to the customers. Throughout the vast hotel there was not, for instance, such a thing as a brush and pan. One had to manage with a broom and a piece of cardboard. And the staff lavatory was worthy of Central Asia. And there was no place to wash one's hands, except the sinks used for washing crockery. In spite of all this, the Hotel X was one of the dozen most expensive hotels in Paris, and the customers paid startling prices. The ordinary charge for a night's lodging, not including breakfast, was 200 francs. All wine and tobacco were sold at exactly double shop prices, though, of course, the patron bought at the wholesale price. If a customer had a title, or was reputed to be a millionaire, all his charges went up automatically. One morning on the fourth floor, an American who was on a diet wanted only salt and hot water for his breakfast. Valenti was furious. "Jesus Christ," he said, "what about my 10%? 10% of salt and water?" And he charged 25 francs for the breakfast. The customer paid without a murmur. According to Boris, the same kind of thing went on in all Paris hotels, or at least in all the big expensive ones. But I imagine that the customers at the Hotel X were especially easy to swindle, for they were mostly Americans, with a sprinkling of English, no French, and seemed to know nothing whatever about good food. They would stuff themselves with disgusting American cereals, and eat marmalade at tea, and drink vermouth after dinner, and order a poulet à la reine at 100 francs, and then souse it in Worcester sauce. One customer from Pittsburgh dined every night in his bedroom on grape nuts, scrambled eggs, and cocoa. Perhaps it hardly matters whether such people are swindled or not. Chapter 15. I heard queer tales in the hotel. They were tales of dope fiends, of old debauchees who frequented hotels in search of pretty page boys, of thefts and blackmail. Mario told me of an hotel in which he had been, where a chambermaid stole a priceless diamond ring from an American lady. For days the staff were searched as they left work, and two detectives searched the hotel from top to bottom, but the ring was never found. The chambermaid had a lover in the bakery, and he had baked the ring into a roll, where it lay unsuspected until the search was over. Once Valenti, at a slack time, told me a story about himself. "You know, mon petit, this hotel life is all very well, but it's the devil when you're out of work. I expect you know what it is to go without eating, eh? Forcément, otherwise you wouldn't be scrubbing dishes. Well, I'm not a poor devil of a plongeur. I'm a waiter, and I went 5 days without eating once. 5 days without even a crust of bread. Jesus Christ! I tell you, those 5 days were the devil. The only good thing was I had my rent paid in advance. I was living in a dirty, cheap little hotel in the Rue Saint-Aloise, up in the Latin Quarter. It was called the Hotel Suzanne Maille, after some famous prostitute of the time of the Empire. I was starving, and there was nothing I could do. I couldn't even go to the cafes where the hotel proprietors come to engage waiters, because I hadn't the price of a drink. All I could do was to lie in bed getting weaker and weaker and watching the bugs running about the ceiling. I don't want to go through that again, I can tell you. In the afternoon of the fifth day, I went half mad. At least, that's how it seems to me now. There was an old faded print of a woman's head hanging on the wall of my room, and I took to wondering who it could be. And after about an hour, I realized that it must be Saint Eloise, who was the patron saint of the quarter. I had never taken any notice of the thing before, but now, as I lay staring at it, a most extraordinary idea came into my head. "Écoute, mon cher," I said to myself, "you'll be starving to death if this goes on much longer. You've got to do something. Why not try a prayer to Saint Eloise? Go down on your knees and ask her to send you some money. After all, it can't do any harm. Try it." Mad, eh? Still, a man will do anything when he's hungry. Besides, as I said, it couldn't do any harm. I got out of bed and began praying. I said, "Dear Saint Eloise, if you exist, please send me some money. I don't ask for much. just enough to buy some bread and a bottle of wine and get my strength back. 3 or 4 francs would do. You don't know how grateful I'll be, Santa Louise, if you help me this once. And be sure if you send me anything, the first thing I'll do will be to go and burn a candle for you at your church down the street. Amen. I put in that about the candle because I'd heard that saints like having candles burnt in their honour. I meant to keep my promise, of course, but I'm an atheist and I didn't really believe that anything would come of it. Well, I got into bed again, and 5 minutes later there came a bang at the door. It was a girl called Maria, a big, fat peasant girl who lived at our hotel. She was a very stupid girl, but a good sort, and I didn't much care for her to see me in the state I was in. She cried out at the sight of me. "Nom de Dieu," she said, "what's the matter with you? What are you doing in bed at this time of day? Quel mien que tu as! You look more like a corpse than a man." Probably I did look a sight. I'd been 5 days without food, most of the time in bed, and it was 3 days since I'd had a wash or a shave. The room was a regular pigsty, too. "What's the matter?" said Maria again. "The matter," I said. "Jesus Christ, I'm starving. I haven't eaten for 5 days, that's what's the matter." Maria was horrified. "Not eaten for 5 days," she said. "But why? Haven't you any money, then?" "Money," I said. "Do you suppose I should be starving if I had money? I've got just 5 sous in the world, and I've pawned everything. Look round the room and see if there's anything more I can sell or pawn. If you can find anything that will fetch 50 centimes, you're cleverer than I am." Maria began looking round the room. She poked here and there among a lot of rubbish that was lying about, and then suddenly she got quite excited. Her great thick mouth fell open with astonishment. "You idiot," she cried out. "Imbecile! What's this, then?" I saw that she had picked up an empty oil bidon that had been lying in the corner. I had bought it weeks before for an oil lamp I had before I sold my things. "That," I said, "that's an oil bidon. What about it?" "Imbecile, didn't you pay 3 francs 50 deposit on it?" Now, of course, I had paid the 3 francs 50. They always make you pay a deposit on the bidon, and you get it back when the bidon is returned, but I'd forgotten all about it. "Yes," I began. "Idiot!" shouted Maria again. She got so excited that she began to dance about, until I thought her sabot would go through the floor. "Idiot! T'es fou! T'es fou! What have you got to do but take it back to the shop and get your deposit back? Starving! With 3 francs 50 staring you in the face! Imbecile!" I can hardly believe now that in all those 5 days I had never once thought of taking the bidon back to the shop. As good as 3 francs 50 in hard cash, and it had never occurred to me. I sat up in bed. "Quick," I shouted to Maria, "you take it for me. Take it to the grocer's at the corner, run like the devil, and bring back food." Maria didn't need to be told. She grabbed the bidon and went clattering down the stairs like a herd of elephants. And in 3 minutes she was back, with 2 pounds of bread under one arm and a half-litre bottle of wine under the other. I didn't stop to thank her. I just seized the bread and sank my teeth in it. Have you noticed how bread tastes when you've been hungry for a long time? Cold, wet, doughy, like putty almost. But Jesus Christ, how good it was! As for the wine, I sucked it all down in one draught, and it seemed to go straight into my veins and flow round my body like new blood. Ah, that made a difference. I wolfed the whole 2 pounds of bread without stopping to take breath. Maria stood with her hands on her hips watching me eat. "Well, you feel better, eh?" she said when I'd finished. "Better," I said. "I feel perfect. I'm not the same man as I was 5 minutes ago. There's only one thing in the world I need now. A cigarette." Maria put her hand in her apron pocket. "You can't have it," she said. "I've no money. This is all I had left out of your 3 francs 50. 7 sous. It's no good. The cheapest cigarettes are 12 sous a packet." "Then I can have them," I said. "Jesus Christ, what a piece of luck. I've got 5 sous. It's just enough." Maria took the 12 sous and was starting out to the tobacconist's. And then something I had forgotten all this time came into my head. There was that cursed Saint Eloise. I had promised her a candle if she sent me money. And really, who could say that the prayer hadn't come true? 3 or 4 francs, I'd said. And the next moment along came 3 francs 50. There was no getting away from it. I should have to spend my 12 sous on a candle. I called Maria back. "It's no use," I said. "There is Saint Eloise. I have promised her a candle. The 12 sous will have to go on that. Silly, isn't it? I can't have my cigarettes after all. Santa Louise? Said Maria. What about Santa Louise? I prayed to her for money and promised her a candle, I said. She answered the prayer. At any rate, the money turned up. I shall have to buy that candle. It's a nuisance, but it seems to me I must keep my promise. But what put Santa Louise into your head? Said Maria. It was her picture, I said, and I explained the whole thing. There she is, you see, I said, and I pointed to the picture on the wall. Maria looked at the picture, and then, to my surprise, she burst into shouts of laughter. She laughed more and more, stamping about the room and holding her fat sides as though they would burst. I thought she'd gone mad. It was 2 minutes before she could speak. Idiot! She cried at last. De fou! De fou! Do you mean to tell me you really knelt down and prayed to that picture? Who told you it was Santa Louise? But I made sure it was Santa Louise, I said. Imbecile! It isn't Santa Louise at all. Who do you think it is? Who? I said. It's Suzanne May, the woman this hotel is called after. I had been praying to Suzanne May, the famous prostitute of the Empire. But after all, I wasn't sorry. Maria and I had a good laugh, and then we talked it over, and we made out that I didn't owe Santa Louise anything. Clearly it wasn't she who had answered the prayer, and there was no need to buy her a candle. So I had my packet of cigarettes after all. Chapter 16. Time went on, and the auberge de Jeanne Cottard showed no signs of opening. Boris and I went down there one day during our afternoon interval and found that none of the alterations had been done, except the indecent pictures, and there were three duns instead of two. The patron greeted us with his usual blandness, and the next instant turned to me, his prospective dishwasher, as prospective dishwasher, and borrowed 5 francs. After that, I felt certain that the restaurant would never get beyond talk. The patron, however, again named the opening for exactly a fortnight from today, and introduced us to the woman who was to do the cooking, a Baltic Russian, 5 feet tall and a yard across the hips. She told us that she had been a singer before she came down to cooking, and that she was very artistic and adored English literature, especially La Casse de l'Oncle Tom. In a fortnight I had got so used to the routine of a plongeur's life that I could hardly imagine anything different. It was a life without much variation. At 5:45 one woke with a sudden start, tumbled into grease-stiffened clothes, and hurried out with dirty face and protesting muscles. It was dawn, and the windows were dark except for the workmen's cafes. The sky was like a vast, flat wall of cobalt, with roofs and spires of black paper pasted upon it. Drowsy men were sweeping the pavements with 10-foot besoms, and ragged families picking over the dustbins.